This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ever been at the pharmacy? You're there to pick up a generic prescription, and then they tell you the price, and you get sticker shock. If so, you've discovered one of the secrets of the generic drug market. Generic doesn't always equal cheap. And in some cases, drug companies can jack up prices of off-patent drugs to, well, pretty much whatever they want. If there's no competition, they know you'll pay the price. And that's what happened this week when Turing Pharmaceuticals, a small drug company, marked up the price of a decades-old toxoplasmosis drug from $13.50 to $750. And, you know, it left many of us wondering, how can they do that? How do they do that? Why don't competitors swoop in and drive down the price if it's a free market after all, right? Well, it turns out that the forces that shape the generic drug market can be a little more complicated than you might think. But my next guests are here to prescribe perhaps a solution as we sort through all of this. Dr. Aaron Kesselheim is Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Med School in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks a lot, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Stephen Schandelmeier is a pharmaceutical economist and professor and director of the Prime Institute at the University of Minnesota. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here as well.
And if you've seen a generic price hike, you give us a call. Our number 844-724-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry. And before we get started, we have a statement from Chip Davis, president and CEO of the Generic Pharmaceutical Association. Let me read this. Turing is not a Generic Pharmaceutical Association member, has no relationship with the GPHA. No single company and no single product represents the entire generic drug industry, which has an undeniable record of patient savings and access. Congress should encourage the timely FDA review of the more than 3,000 generic drug applications that have been filed with the agency. Once those are approved, consumers will have more options than ever, and that will help drive down prices. Aaron, let's start with the case of the Turing Pharmaceuticals. Why are we so surprised? I mean, isn't it the point of being a corporation to be holding to stockholders to maximize their profits? Isn't it totally a fair business practice to jack up the price to $750 a pill if people will pay for that?
Well, actually, it is. There isn't any illegal antitrust reason why this company can't do it, assuming that they receive their monopoly in a legal fashion. And we can actually talk about that because one component of their monopoly is this restricted distribution scheme in which they're preventing other companies from potentially obtaining samples of the drug to test and in order to get competing products on the market. But putting that aside, yeah, it is within the company's rights if they have a natural monopoly to charge whatever they want for their product. And I think that people are upset because, like you were saying at the top of your show, when people hear generic, they assume that something is cheap. But the only reason that generic drugs are cheap is because there's effective competition. And in this case, when there isn't effective competition, the market is at the mercy of the seller.
Stephen, you've said that the pharmaceutical industry is the only sector of the U.S. economy with no sort of price regulation. Really?
Well, it's the only one where we don't have a government agency looking at price policy and economic impact of various policies that we make. You know, we look at the agricultural industry, we look at communications, we look at Wall Street, and there are various policies and things that look at the economic impact of decisions that are made, yet we don't evaluate that as a U.S. government. And in this case, in pharmaceuticals, functional monopolies can evolve because of the regulations we have in place. So because of regulations that are appropriately in place for safety and effectiveness, it results in a case where other competitors can't enter the generic market quickly. It may take 3 to 4 years for generic competitors to come in to challenge this product that has suddenly raised its price.
And explain how that happens. Why can't somebody just come in and offer the same thing?
Well, to begin making and selling a pharmaceutical, first you have to develop the product and make sure you have a stable product that compares equally in terms of safety and effectiveness to the product on the market. Secondly, you have to get the FDA to approve your manufacturing process and facility. And then you have to do bioavailability studies and show that you produce the same amount of active ingredient in a patient's blood or body at the site of activity compared to the reference listed drug. And then you have to submit an abbreviated new drug application to the Food and Drug Administration and wait on them to review and approve it.
Wow.
And each of those steps takes a long time.
Aaron, there's a pretty big wait at the FDA to get new generics approved, right?
Yes. In fact, the queue at the FDA Office of Generic Drugs, I think, is around 3 years before they'll even look at the application. And that's because, you know, as a society, we're underfunding this aspect of the regulation of the marketplace. Most of the funds at the FDA go to their review and approval of new drugs. And even though generic drugs are 85% of the prescriptions that U.S. patients receive, there is far less oversight of the generic drug market. And as a result, you've got these long lines at the FDA because the FDA just simply doesn't have the resources. Now, that was supposed to change with legislation in 2012 that started requiring generic companies to pay a user fee to the FDA to provide some funding. But we haven't seen a substantial shift yet in the queue.
So if you had four or five competitors out there, you would keep the price of the generic down, but you don't have those kind of competitions. In fact, in the case of Turing, didn't they take the drug off the open market, meaning it was harder for competitors to get samples to test their generics against?
Right. Well, that was what Steve was saying. I mean, the beginning of the process and doing all the tests that he was talking about requires having samples of the comparator drug to test against. And what this company tried to do in this case was prevent that from happening by moving the drug from a drug that you could get at any pharmacy to a drug that you could only obtain through one specific specialty pharmacy, and that restricts the ability of competitors to obtain a sample for the appropriate testing.
There was another story that sort of flew under the radar as this one came out about the same time. There was another price hike of a tuberculosis drug, Rodelis, and the nonprofit that used to own the drug, after this drug was hiked up, demanded to have the rights back. That looks kind of interesting. Can you walk us through what happened there?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a very similar story to this case, which is that a small firm, and I wouldn't necessarily call it a drug company necessarily, but a small private firm decided that there was this area where it could make some money, and so it purchased the rights and increased the price. And I think that now that it seems like the CEO of Turing has backed down a little bit and has said that he's going to reduce the price, although we don't know what that's going to be, people may go back and think that the problem's been solved. But I think the fact is that this kind of thing happens in a lot of corners of the generic drug marketplace where there isn't sufficient competition. And this cycloserine tuberculosis drug example is another good example of that, and another good example where some public shaming ultimately led to a reversal of the issue. But I don't think we can rely on public shaming for every single episode in which this happens, and need a little bit more active oversight of the market to try to prevent these sorts of things from occurring.
Mm-hmm. How can we make
that right? And I would comment that. It's not just this recent event. It's not the only case of a drug going up dramatically in price.
So I just have a few minutes left.
Yeah.
I want to get to the answer.
Sure.
What do we do to keep? Can you put a cap on it? You know, what can you do to keep the price down?
Well, there's no government agency or no authority to regulate price in any way at this point. Canada has a price review board that looks at the prices that are charged for their patented drugs, but it could be applied to generic drugs as well in a market. And that board could review prices, and then if they feel they are unjustified, ask the manufacturer to justify that, and or the board could then say, no, you can't charge that price, you have to lower it to a certain amount.
Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton announced her plan on prescription meds this week. Bernie Sanders has been working on it in Congress. Is going to be a big election issue, do you think, Bo?
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems like a lot of people are really charged up about this. And I think that there are aspects of the Sanders plan and the Clinton plan, both of which are, you know, have good ideas in them, and some of which may help address some of these problems. But I think, you know, until we get better oversight of the market that could come from, you know, CMS, which currently covers 100 million patient lives in terms of their prescription drug coverage, if they were more active in looking at the market and trying to anticipate when these kinds of things might happen because the number of manufacturers drops or it changes hands, the drug changes hands or something like that, then you could imagine a coordinated system between CMS and FDA to try to, you know, put potential competitors to the top of the queue, or to try to do things that would try to incentivize manufacturers to enter the market. All these things will require some congressional authorization. But I do think that there are a lot of people out there who are worked up about this, and on the both Democrat and Republican side of the aisle.
Yeah, maybe we'll get a question in the next debate about this, perhaps. You know, we don't.
Perhaps.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, I think there are things that we can do. The government can do compulsory licensing if they feel there's a public health emergency and drugs not available or people are not getting access for whatever reason. They could compulsory license other competitors to make the drug and fast track their approval. But the U.S. has never exercised that particular option. I was saying earlier, there are hundreds of generic drugs that have had price spikes on a similar magnitude as this, and they've gone unnoticed, partly because they were in hospital settings where they're used primarily, or they just, for whatever reason, didn't get noticed. So this is not the exception. I think we would be fooling ourselves if we say this is just an odd case, and so don't worry about it, because there are hundreds of cases like this.
I do also want to say that even though there are hundreds of, I completely agree that there are a lot of cases like this, there are, you know, generic drugs are still an for the most part an extremely good deal, and, you know, promote low cost care and are extremely inexpensive. So I think that for the most part generic drugs are doing what we want them to do, but we need better oversight for these particular episodes.
All right, we've run out of time. Well, I thank you both for taking time to be with us. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about another kind of fuel cell electric car. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Support for this podcast comes from Universal Pictures presenting Steve Jobs. What interests you about Steve Jobs? I found him fascinating because he followed his own dream. And now the Academy Award-winning director of Slumdog Millionaire, Danny Boyle, and the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of The Social Network, Aaron Sorkin, have teamed up and made a definitive movie about Steve Jobs called, appropriately enough, Steve Jobs. It stars Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs with Kate Winslet, Seth Rogen, and Jeff Daniels in select theaters starting October 9th and everywhere October 16th. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In October, the first Formula E competition, that is a car race for electric cars only, it's going to race down the speedway in Japan and probably the quietest racetrack you will ever hear. Toyota is recently releasing the Mirai. It's a hydrogen fuel cell car in the next few weeks. It's out there in California, and there's been talk that Apple is trying to get into the electric car game. No word yet on how many different colors they're going to offer. Maybe they'll have an S version. Just kidding. Are fuel cell and plug-in cars finally mainstream and ready for the road, or is the technology still over the horizon? Have you driven an electric car? Do you have a question about how these cars work? Give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. My next guests are here to discuss just that. Levi Tilleman is a fellow at the New America Foundation, an author of The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
You're welcome. Craig Scott is the National Manager for Advanced Technology for Toyota's U.S. Motor Sales based out of Torrance, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, thanks so much for having me today.
You're welcome. And I got actually to drive one of Toyota's hydrogen fuel cell cars when I was out in Colorado, and you can watch a video of that test drive on our website at sciencefriday.com/test drives. Craig, tell us about the Mirai. Where, when, what, the W's on? What's happening there?
Well, we're really excited. It's just a few weeks away now, we're going to officially launch for the first time sales of a fuel cell electric vehicle here in the U.S. As you might know, it's been on sale in Japan for a few months now. But this will be the first time for U.S. consumers to get a chance to actually own a real live fuel cell electric vehicle.
And is there still a battery on board?
There is. It's a hybrid, so it actually shares the battery with our Camry hybrid vehicle. So it's about a 1.6 kilowatt battery that helps balance the load from the fuel cell.
And if the fuel cell, I know, runs on hydrogen, so that means you have to set up a whole infrastructure of refueling stations.
That's correct. Yeah, so it runs on high-pressure hydrogen, and that infrastructure network is now in the process of being developed here in California. We're very happy that the state of California has supported that actively with about $200 million of funding.
Mm-hmm. Levi, what do you think about the technology of the Mirai car?
Well, first of all, I think Toyota is a fantastic company. They have a willingness to make long-term technology bets like few other companies that exist in the world today. They've given us a Toyota production system, and we're really the father of the hybrid electric vehicle. And so they've done huge things for the industry. But I think it's important to remember in the context of fuel cell vehicles that what Toyota is doing here is really kind of deployed R&D. And I think that's part of what makes it a special company. They're willing to take these cutting-edge technologies and put them in the hands of consumers at a very early stage so they can gather knowledge for the long run as to how these vehicles are going to perform once they reach a mass market. But this year, they're only going to be about 700 Mirai vehicles sold in the entire world. So we're talking about a very, very small sliver of the 10 million vehicles that Toyota sells every year.
But didn't Tesla start out with a tiny amount of cars, too?
Tesla did, but I think the difference was that Tesla was a company that was dedicated to the premise of bringing electric cars to market. Toyota is a massive manufacturer, one of the largest companies in the world, and this is really testing the waters for Toyota rather than changing the game.
Craig, why did Tesla choose a fuel cell, a hydrogen fuel cell, instead of a battery-powered car?
Why did Toyota choose a fuel cell, you mean?
I'm sorry, yes.
We chose a fuel cell vehicle platform, really, instead of just a pure battery electric vehicle platform. Really for the main reasons of the sort of alluding to, and that is we would like to make this a mass market vehicle. The idea is to, although yes, we've only announced 3,000 units for the first 3 years, our plans and our ambitions are, of course, much bigger and much broader than that. But the reality is that, you know, if you want to make significant, serious contributions to reduction of greenhouse gases or carbon intensity, you need to have, you know, more people driving more efficient cars, not less people. And so we think that the fuel cell platform really offers the opportunity for many, many, many customers to get into the technology and to get into a carbon-free technology, because the trade-off really is none for compared to a gasoline car, other than, of course, the infrastructure that's now in progress. But I think maybe, you know, you can attest to it when you drove it in Colorado, that it drives just like a regular car, operates like a regular car. You can refuel it in 3 to 5 minutes, and you do 300, 350 miles on a trip.
Mm-hmm. It drove very nicely. It had tremendous acceleration, as all electric cars do.
Thank you.
My question is, can you get the infrastructure to put the hydrogen fuel built quickly enough? And I have also a suggestion. You know, people have big propane tanks in their backyards that they use for natural gas for heating and cooking. Why can't you just bring the fuel to the people in a tank like that and let them pump it themselves instead of a gas station?
Good question. So I think that the first answer to your first question would be that, you know, the infrastructure is coming along. Of course, we would like it to come faster. And really, the infrastructure has to come before the cars, right? People don't really want to buy a car they can't use. So, you know, we are doing a lot, obviously, ourselves as automakers and as Toyota, especially, to help that process along, right? So we've invested in two big projects, one in California and one in the Northeast, to help spur the development of infrastructure, and we'd like to see that continue. Obviously, Japan is a big market for us, and that's happening there very rapidly, as well as Germany. This is a global initiative, not just a California initiative. And with respect to, you know, home refueling, sure, it's possible. It's a little bit expensive today, and I think that we often ask ourselves internally, you know, is that really, the best long-term future. It could be. I think that there needs to be a lot of technical improvements that have to come first. But, you know, we've had the sort of centralized refueling distribution and business model for nearly 100 years now, if not already 100 years. And it works very well, and it's scalable, and it allows vehicles to, lots of vehicles to come to one place and refuel at one time, which I think offers a lot of economies of scale. And that's really a big important point for us, right? Mm-hmm. A hydrogen station can be, just like a gasoline station, it can be set up to do 100 cars, it can be set up to do 1,000 cars. And that's important if you're talking about mass adoption.
Levi, why can't they coexist? I can't.
Well, I think they can, and they will. But you've hit on a key point, which is that in some ways, the electric vehicle is fundamentally more disruptive. You can very easily imagine a future where we all put solar panels on our homes, and then we plug our electric vehicles into outlets that are connected to those solar panels. And that really takes you out of this massive industry which supplies fuel. It allows you to have your own autonomous electric vehicle system. But the difference with hydrogen is that you do need a huge amount of infrastructure, and it's centralized infrastructure. And there's not very much of it out there today. I mean, there are 12 public hydrogen refueling stations in the entire country, with about 10 of those in California. That's compared to about 10,000 public EV refueling stations. And of course, you can refuel an EV anywhere that you have a plug. And so really, I mean, there are millions and millions, if not hundreds of millions, of potential EV fueling stations around the country. And then you compare that to our current infrastructure for gasoline, where we have about 115,000 gasoline stations in this country. And so Toyota is really trailblazing with this technology, but there's a long way to go.
Craig, where do you...
I would disagree that that's completely... Levi. I mean, it's...
go ahead.
It
disagree.
Is a, I agree. It is... I mean, and with the very first point, that this is not an and or... or this is not an or, fuel cell or EV. This is an and, right? So the fuel cells and electric vehicles, battery electric vehicles. Of course, fuel cells are also electric vehicles. Because, and nobody really reasonably should deny this, right? Because if the ultimate goal is to have more zero emission vehicle technology in the marketplace, and you want to give consumers as many choices as they want. For our point of view, we still believe that fuel cells cater to a lot more of your sort of typical consumer driving profile.
Mm-hmm. And how will you make the hydrogen?
So today, a vast majority of hydrogen, 95-98% of it, comes from natural gas. It's a process called steam methane reformation, and it's been happening for as long as we've had gasoline. Honestly, it's if not longer. It is a feedstock, I think, as you might know, into gasoline. So hydrogen is often, or is intentionally, put into the process of refining gasoline to clean it up. Mm-hmm. So you're already using hydrogen in your fuel today, actually.
Mm-hmm. You worked, Craig, on launching the Prius. How does launching the Mirai compare to getting the Prius out the door?
I did work on Prius, and it was also a very fun program for the company. And I think that it is, in a lot of ways, very similar. We're seeing a lot of similarity of mindset for the customer. Very interested, obviously, and as Levi said, trailblazing technology and being a pioneer and being at the forefront. It's a little different in that, in some senses, although it's more difficult considering the infrastructure, it's a little easier in that we are, as a society and as consumers, a lot further along. We've been selling Prius for about 15 years now in the U.S. And what that's done is it's begun to shift people's mentalities about alternative fuel vehicles and hybrids. And so moving to a hydrogen-powered hybrid is not, I think, as big of a stretch as it would have been if we didn't have Prius and hybrids before it.
Mm-hmm. Levi, China is getting into the electric car market. Are they going to be able to compete with the cars already out on the market, or what's their view? What's their business plan?
Well, China's a fascinating story, because if we had talked about China just 18 months ago, I would have said that their EV program was basically dead in the water. But just last year, China instituted a new set of policies, which included mandates for local governments to purchase a certain percent of their fleet vehicles as EVs. And now China is on track to be the largest EV market in the world. And so they, through some clever policy adjustments, have overtaken Japan, the United States, and Europe, as the largest single country EV market in the world.
Mm-hmm. And Craig, would they be a target for Toyota?
Would China be a target for?
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, Toyota's selling vehicles into China, and it's an important market for us. And I think we'll have to wait and see how it all unfolds. Of course, you know, where the electricity is coming from in China would be the first question that I would ask. Likewise, the same is true for anywhere else. I mean, we have to think about not just the emissions at the vehicle, but also completely upstream.
I mean, like coal, something like that.
That's
really the main issue with hydrogen fuel cell vehicles as well. I mean, I can see the potential in hydrogen fuel cells. They are potentially a great technology for long distance, zero emission travel. But the problem is that right now they don't produce much less CO2 than your standard hybrid electric vehicle because of the fact that hydrogen comes from methane. And when you produce the hydrogen from methane, you release a lot of CO2 and it requires a lot of energy. So the hope is that someday in the future, we'll be able to come up with a way to produce zero carbon hydrogen. And if we're able to do that, then hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are a great mm-hmm. idea. But until then, it's hard to find their place in a very low or zero carbon future.
And I'd say the same is true, the same is true for EVs, right? So we also have to find a way to develop more carbon-free electricity, right? And so I think that, most peer-reviewed studies, things that have argon in these places are showing that, fuel cells and EVs are about on par with each other from an emissions point of view, which is to say they're roughly 50% cleaner than a standard gasoline vehicle. So all things considered, again, mm-hmm. The goal is to make sure that we're all moving towards zero technology and zero emission vehicle technology in some way, shape, or form, whether that's battery or fuel cell. But the really sort of important part to think about for the long-term future is what is scalable. Is renewable hydrogen more or less scalable than pure electric generation through solar or through wind? And there's a lot of studies about that, and a lot of people talking about that. And then how do you handle sort of curtailed renewables, if you will, and what role does hydrogen play mm-hmm. in that?
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about electric cars with Craig Scott and Levi Tillman. Levi, you want to jump in, I hear.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say that there's a big debate as to whether electric vehicles are on par or much, much better than a fuel-efficient hybrid electric vehicle. And most of the good research that I've seen says that they're dramatically more efficient from the standpoint of carbon emissions than either a hybrid or a potential hydrogen vehicle. The Union of Concerned Scientists is actually coming out with a pretty thorough study on this in the next month or two, and it will be interesting to see what their conclusions are. But in my experience, the reports that I've seen that do a thorough analysis of the carbon footprint of these vehicles show that electric vehicles by far have the potential to be the cleanest of all cars. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, any word on what Project Titan at Apple is all about, on their plans for an electric car or any car?
Apple is a
They're so close-mouthed about everything, aren't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, I mean, they're a notoriously secretive company, and they do not like to talk publicly about what's coming next. Now, there are a lot of media reports out there that have talked about what the shape of the Apple car might be. Some people have said that it's going to be a mobile office. Some people have said it's going to look like a minivan. Some people have quoted high-level Apple execs as saying Apple is going to give Tesla a run for its money. So we don't really know what the Project Titan looks like. But what we do know is that there is a lot of buzz around it in the media, and that Apple has raised their R&D budget for the coming years substantially. And mm-hmm. so I think that indicates that it seems like they might be making a significant investment.
Craig, how does a car company like Toyota, a giant car company, how do you plan how many years down the road for when these things happen?
We are traditionally, obviously, as you mentioned, a long-term planning company. So we often set sort of 100-year visions and then start working backwards from a product planning point of view, having things in the pipeline that are, mm-hmm. 2 to 3 decades away is not unusual for us. We are, of course, always surveying the landscape to see what potential disruptions there could be, including Apple, and planning accordingly.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're gonna be very interested in watch how all of this turns out with because you know even Elon Musk he said I welcome competition. You know, he would like to see an electric future. He's got the solar city. He's got the cars. I think he's very much happy to have a competition. At least he's told us that. So we'll have to see how all of this shakes out in the future. I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Craig Scott, National Manager for Advanced Technologies for Toyota's U.S. Motor Sales, based out in Torrance, California. And Levi Telemann is a fellow at the New American Foundation, author of The Great Race, The Global Quest for the Car of the Future. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you both.
You're welcome. After the break, we're gonna talk trash, a little trash talking here. Not anything you have to turn the radio off for. We're gonna talk about how much waste are we really putting into landfills, and where do landfills start? History, everything you want to know about landfills and waste. After this break, stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Do you live by a garbage dump or a landfill? You know, wherever you find people, you're bound to find trash. Garbage is a fact of life. But how we manage our waste has changed over the years. Dumps have evolved from fenced-off spots outside of town to huge methane monsters like the defunct Puente Hills landfill in California, covering 700 acres. The mountains of garbage were 500 feet high and produced enough methane to fuel a small city. And that, dumps like that, landfills are not unknown. So how did we get to be a landfill nation? And is that a bad thing? My next guest is here to fill us in on the history of landfilling. Robin Nagel is the anthropologist in residence for the New York City Department of Sanitation. She's also author of the book Picking Up. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You know, New Yorkers certainly know what am I going to say? Stranger to landfills, right?
We built a lot of the city on top of garbage, quite literally. Approximately 20% of the larger metropolitan region is built on fill. Not all of that is landfill garbage, but a lot of it is. And fully 33% of Manhattan, south of 14th Street. So we are walking on trash pretty much every day.
And this is history of the world, isn't it? If you go to Rome or you go to Jerusalem or wherever, you see people have basically bulldozed they've conquered the nation and bulldozed them and just built right on top of them.
We've been doing it for centuries.
Yeah. Before we had landfills and even dumps, people would toss trash out their windows. When was the idea of the landfill started?
Well, the formal landfill, as distinct from a dump, was first pioneered in the United States in Fresno, California, by a sanitary engineer named Jean, Vincennes. And he came up with the idea of digging trenches, burying the waste, covering it with fill, usually earth, and compacting it so that you didn't just have raw trash lying around on the ground or on the edge of a waterway. And it actually was a technology full of flaws, of course, back then, but it was a sea change in thinking about what do we do with our waste. If we're going to dump it somewhere, couldn't we do it in a way that's less noxious, that's less awful for people who have to be downwind from it, that might have fewer vermin? It was a revolutionary change, although not one that's generally celebrated.
Yeah, and
although it should be.
Why should it be?
Because imagine if we had never come up with a way to make a landfill that is less dynamic in a smelly, juicy kind of way, and that once it's buried according to sort of the best technology we have, for better or worse, you now have land you can use for many other purposes. So if we still had open dumps, cities would be very difficult places to live. And there are all kinds of resources and geographies and parks and urban development all over the world, for better or worse, that's on top of land-filled land.
Who came up with the revolutionary idea that you could build on top of an old landfill?
I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that we had been doing it already for probably hundreds of years, because especially ancient cities, some of what would qualify as landfilled space goes down very deep and has been built upon by generation after generation. So the sort of the formal policy of building on it, it's not a modern, yeah, it's not a modern innovation.
But Robert Moses, who was well known as the king of New York here for a while, in building highways and buildings, did he not come up with a way to build on top of landfills?
Sure, but he was not the first person to do that. There, yeah, are all kinds of stories of New York land and land all over the world that was built from fill. Moses did it perhaps more strategically and certainly more aggressively than had been the case before him. He commanded the final resting place of every ton of trash in New York City for decades, and we live with the consequences of that every day. He basically gave shape to the contemporary geography of the city by using trash strategically to make landfill that was then the foundation of highways and bridges and parks and beaches and the contemporary city.
Do we still have trash barges? I remember some very famous trash barges not being able to find a home after leaving New York.
That was the Mobro. That was the garbage barge, as it was called. We have one marine-based transfer of paper right now in New York City. So there are barges still used, but that's only to take paper recycling to the recycling facility on Staten Island. Once the marine transfer stations currently under construction, once those are up and running, we will once again have a water-based transportation system for some of our municipal trash, which echoes a pattern that we've had, again, for a long history. What will be completely different now, and has been completely different since 1934, we will not be dumping anything in the sea. We did that for generations until finally the United States Supreme Court said, knock it off. We'd had protests from people living in New Jersey and along the beaches in Coney Island and Long Island for generations, but we didn't come up with a better alternative until finally it took the Supreme Court to say, just stop now. So we did in 34. Mm-hmm. But then we started building more landfills and incinerators. It has to go somewhere. That's the conundrum.
There's not enough recycling to handle all of the trash.
No, well, there could be, but then you have to have a market for the recycled. It's the feedstock of plastics and glass and metal and paper and whatnot. And if it's not profitable, then without a market incentive, recycling sort of stutters now and then. And municipal waste only accounts for 3% of the nation's waste stream. So even if every city in the entire country were recycling everything perfectly, we would still have a trash problem that we would need to address. And we'd have to look not at the curb, but upstream at the source of commodities and whatnot. So it's a complex picture.
I'll bet you. I've got to ask you about your job. You've been an anthropologist in residence with the New York City Sanitation Department for 9 years. What does an anthropologist have to do with sanitation?
That, Ira, I could spend all day answering, but I know our time is limited. So
give me a minute.
I have a primary goal, which is to help translate to a larger public why sanitation is, in my very strongly argued opinion, the most important uniformed force on the streets of the city, and then translate to sanitation people the same thing, why their job is so fundamentally important for the city's daily well-being and historically across time, our well-being. I am not in any way calling out or putting down any of the other uniformed forces on the streets of New York, but if sanitation is not there, we don't really have a city that we can live in and as we do today, that we can imagine ourselves sort of a global capital sparkling on the seaside. We need them out there every day to save us from ourselves.
And
I'm trying to make that message very clear.
You only notice it when they're gone or they're on strike or not picking up the garbage. Then you see how important all of that is.
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Robin, for taking time to be with us today.
Sure. Thank you.
Robin Nagel is anthropologist in residence for the New York City Department of Sanitation, and she is author of Picking Up. It's out there since 2014. I suggest you read her book and get some more insight into what she's doing. I'd like to introduce getting a handle on how much trash is really out there can help us manage our garbage more effectively. Easier, of course, it's easier said than done. A group of researchers put out a number in a study published this week, and they said that Americans tossed out 262 million tons of household waste in 2012, and that's a big number, and that's double the amount that the EPA estimated for that same year. Why the discrepancy? That study was published in the journal Nature Climate Change, and where did all that missing trash come from? What impact does it have on the environment? John Powell is an author on that study. He's also a doctoral student in chemical and environmental engineering at Yale University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. This is can't think of a better way to spend a Friday here, so glad to be here.
Well, thank you. You're very kind. Now, you estimate that there is two times the amount that the EPA says. That's a big difference. How did you get that discrepancy?
That's right. The key really lies in the methodology. In the past, the way that we had to come up with these kinds of numbers was to use things like census data, Department of Commerce data, and other business activity information to come up with an estimate of how much is being generated, and then from that, how much is being disposed, how much is being combusted, and all the mm-hmm. other things we do with waste. And so this number, we're the beneficiaries of just a beautiful, rich data set that is made available by the EPA as a result of a regulation passed in 2009, which essentially required large emitters of CO2 to gather a bunch of data and submit it electronically to estimate their CO2 emissions. So part of the metadata from this information EPA has, we were able to back out that number, that 262 million tons number. And I will say that that's metric tons.
Right.
If we're thinking U.S. and short tons, it's about 289 million tons.
Well, where did that extra trash come from? Can you isolate what it was that they didn't account for?
The beauty of the data and why I'm so excited about it and the number that we were able to put out and some of the subsequent observations is that this is measured data from individual facilities. And so there are about 1,200 individual landfills, both open and actively receiving waste and closed. Obviously, the closed ones are not reporting any waste disposal numbers, but essentially aggregating all of the data from the open landfills. And it was somewhere about 900 to 950 sites we were able to come up with our estimate. And so again, these are measured data from very large data set.
I guess I'm asking, what kinds of trash was it that makes up for the missing? Or did you not, say, well, it's this kind of garbage, that kind of garbage?
Well, the sites that are subject to this greenhouse gas reporting rule that I mentioned are municipal solid waste landfills. And so these are sites that are principally taking household wastes and similar kinds of garbage from commercial businesses. Now, we did we did some numerical exercises to look at some other potential wastes like construction debris that might be in there. And we also looked at the contribution that smaller landfills that aren't subject to this rule might contribute, and ultimately those numbers were fairly small when compared to that overarching 262 mm-hmm. million tons number.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking about trash. Talking trash with John Powell. On all of this trash, I mean, you go to sites. You look at garbage dumps or landfills. All this methane that comes out of these sites. What did you find out about how we're managing the methane coming from all these landfills?
Well, we took that. What does that disposal number tell us? In isolation, maybe not a whole lot, but one of the byproducts of landfilled waste is that you've got organic material that ends up getting broken down by bacteria. And as you mentioned, Ira, they were creating methane as a result of that. Now, about 20 years ago, the EPA passed a regulation requiring landfills of a certain size to put in engineered systems to extract and destroy that methane, essentially combust it. Mm-hmm. And what we wanted to look at was how are these systems performing? You know, we've never been able to get our hands on such a massive data set before. So looking at about 850 or so sites and the performance there, what we found the most distinguishing factor between those sites that were collecting very well and those not collecting as well was whether or not it was open and actively receiving waste or whether it was closed.
And methane's a potent environmental gas, a greenhouse gas. Do we have these sites giving off a large amount or, if not large, a significant amount of methane?
Well, one thing we didn't focus necessarily on that aggregate number. What we wanted to really get at, get to the heart of performance. And so that difference that we found in between sites that are closed and sites that are open was about 17 percentage points. So essentially what that number tells us is that there's some extra room for us to improve the way that we're collecting gas at our open sites. And so I'll just give you a numerical example. Let's say a site is generating 2,000 cubic feet of gas, landfill gas, every minute. If we're only collecting, let's say, 1,000 cubic feet per minute of that, so 50%, we're leaving about 2.5 megawatts of electricity equivalents really kind of on the table. So that's kind of illustrative of what that what that enhanced performance can provide us.
Before you were a graduate student, I know you were an engineer on site at a landfill. What was the most difficult thing about that job?
So I worked in the research and consulting space, really working primarily with waste and materials management. So I think one of the more challenging things, and really very closely related to some of the things we talked about in our paper here, was that at open landfills, it's almost a permanent construction project. So imagine, Ira, you've got these areas that you've built to be protective of the environment, to take in this new waste material. You've got bulldozers, you've got dump trucks, you've got these specialized pieces of equipment called compactors that are compressing the waste, and you're constantly moving your location every single day. And so when we think of it in the context of trying to harness all of this gas that's being created and it's happening every day, trying to put in systems in such a way that we can really effectively collect that gas, it's very challenging. And we observed that and certainly made that point in the paper as well, that so we've identified where that area of improvement is, but that's not a trivial task to capture that either.
Yeah, well, you've done a good job in the paper. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
I appreciate it very much, Ira.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you.
John Powell is a doctoral student in chemical and environmental engineering at Yale University. That's about all the time we have. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, New York, New York, 10036, or email us at scifry@sciencefriday.com. And also we're on the, on the web all week. You can go to our website, sciencefriday.com, get on our mailing list. We also have great teaching materials there. And also we're on Facebook and we're tweeting all week. We've got all kinds of videos up on our website and stuff to keep in touch with us all week.